Hello, everyone.
Hello.
Welcome back to Murder on Tap. I am your host, Jose, and this is the other host,
Ali.
The other one.
Insert your name here.
Yes, fill in the blank.
It's me.
We're starting off a little differently because it's been a rough week with a major tragedy that happened on Sunday morning.
Yes.
With the death of, well, the tragic death of Kobe Bryant, his daughter, and seven other people involved in a helicopter crash.
Yes.
And, yeah. Our hearts, our prayers, everything prayers. Go out to the families of everybody that tragically passed. And, yeah, it's just a big blow to everyone around the world.
Major.
You know, big hearts. Time. It's.
I may not be a big basketball fan, but I mean, this really hit hard.
Yeah, it's we lost not only a role model for kids now and before, and
great basketball player, husband,
but an icon to LA, a legend,
all around legend,
and then including his young 13-year-old daughter. Yeah. Gianna. And everybody else involved. I think there was a family of
a mother, a father, and a daughter.
Two of their kids. Oh, is there?
Yeah.
Yeah, I believe he was a coach himself.
Yes.
But yeah, and then the pilot, everything. It was just a bad situation. And like we said, our prayers and thoughts and everything go out to everybody involved as part of the family, and you know. Yeah, it's a hard one to move on from, but
it definitely is. But fans are keeping his memory alive, and Gianna's memory alive, and all the other families that are involved, and it sucks. It sucks the way it happened, and just, it's a very big loss, but the way people are coming together to honor him and show their love is...
It shows you what an impact he had and yeah. Everybody had.
Big time.
To everyone.
Big time.
But, yeah.
So keep the posts coming and posting, if that makes sense, what I just said. But that's all we can do at this point.
Keep the name alive.
For sure.
The names of everyone.
That was a shitty start to your 2020.
Yeah.
Sadly to say.
The worst possible ending to... The first month of the year.
Yeah. Not including everything that's going on with this whole coronavirus.
Yeah, that's another thing.
Epidemic.
Be careful when traveling.
Absolutely. Wash your hands. I don't know if that makes a big difference.
Well, I think it's transmitted more through cough.
Yeah, which I stuff, heard so. That a lot of the face masks... are like literally being rationed at this point, or they're sold out everywhere.
Yeah, I saw an article that kind of said that they were pretty much saying that it's not needed. But you never know. If you really want to take the precaution, then, you know.
It's not needed, but it could be transmitted through cough.
Yeah, I don't know. I didn't read into it exactly, but I'm thinking because it's not really... spread out over here as it wouldn't be over there. Because over there, it's...
It's pretty bad.
It's bad.
There's like over 7,000 cases right now.
They quarantined, was it
Wuhan?
Wuhan. It's a very populated city, so...
Yeah.
Yeah. It's getting crazy out there.
Well, boy.
And, yeah, we hope everybody stays safe and healthy.
Absolutely.
And, yeah. Hopefully we could get your mind off of things for a little bit.
Yes.
For at least the next 40 minutes or so. By the sound of Allie's note-taking, or by the look of it, You're going to be here for about 3.5 hours.
Yes. Usually we release our episodes on Tuesday, but my notes took me a little bit longer than they should have, so...
For the diehard fans, they remember about Mondays.
Well, diehard fans. Or three fans.
Yeah, the two. But, one of them's left.
I think one of them is us because... But anyway.
I don't even listen to this podcast.
Well, I do. Terrible. But regardless, let's hope for a better February and months ahead. But with that, would you like to jump into the beer of the week, Jose? Because my palate is thirsty.
Yes. Let's try this one. Hold on.
Oh, we got a bottle this time, you guys. Nice job.
Oh, what the hell? There you go.
Oh, with the opening.
It has a plastic coating over the bottle cap.
Fancy. It's like wine, but it's...
Okay, let me have your glass, please.
It's like a fine Chianti. I'm just kidding.
I'll reach over and get it.
Sorry, I was going to give it to you and then you had... Oh, that's the classic sound we're always looking for.
A little ASMR for you guys.
Oh my goodness. Thank you.
Okay.
Oh my gosh. Pretty. This is like a...
And there's still some left over.
Well then, fill her up.
Okay, well...
She's gonna leave me hanging with a half a cup? Okay, alright. Woohoo!
Alrighty, and there's still some left over still.
Let me just say, I have not had beer since Sunday.
I believe you're lying, but...
No, I haven't.
Oh, you're right. Yeah, you're right.
I haven't drank since Sunday, so this is gonna be good. I've been trying to take it easy. Kind of proud of myself. I've been doing good.
That's good.
You know? But...
I congratulate you.
Thanks.
And at the same time, I scold you.
I am soups proud of myself.
Allie eats soups.
I love soup. Okay. Tell us, Jose, what are we drinking today?
All right. Today's beer... is from the North Coast Brewing Company.
Mm-hmm.
They were founded in 1988.
Wait, have we done North Coast before?
I'm not really sure. It's been a few beers.
Sheet.
But I don't think so.
Okay. I can't remember, but maybe we've just had one of their beers and...
No, we've had it. We have, like, the Prankster before.
Oh, maybe that's it.
Yeah, we haven't done it here, but...
I think we were supposed to do it here, but then we just got a little too thirsty and we drank it.
No. Well, maybe. Founded in 1988 as a brew pub. It was founded by Mark Rudrich, Tom Allen, and Doug Moody.
Mm-hmm.
It is a craft brewery located in Fort Bragg, California.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. In 1996... so they were a brew pub, and in 1996 they gained rights to the Acme Brewing Company brand, which was originally founded in San Francisco in 1907. They are the exclusive beer and major sponsor of the Monterey Jazz Festival, the Mendocino Film Festival, the SF Jazz, and the Oregon Jazz Party.
Wow, that's pretty big.
Yeah. And, yeah, it's they're all around.
Mm.
You know, they started off small and then they ended up building up to where they were able to do their own thing, and now they're sponsoring that thing, you know, exclusively.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
Not just, hey, you know, let's get a few out here and we'll try it. Nope.
Yeah, no, it's pretty big to be part of an exclusive.
And that many type of festivals.
Lineup like that.
Yeah. Okay. I didn't find much on it. I'm sure there was a lot more that I'm leaving out, and I apologize, but let's get to it. Oh, wait, hold on. Wait a second. Some of the beers that North Coast Brewing Company has is the Old Rasputin.
Old Rasputin makes North Coast? Yep. I mean, North Coast makes...
Mm-hmm,
really?
Mm-hmm. You remember that one?
Oh, shit. Yeah, I remember that one.
11 or 10.5 or something?
It was 11%. We used to drink that all the time.
Mm-hmm. Which
and
is
it
a...
it was in a...
little four-pack.
But it wasn't 12 Bevmo. Ounces, was it? I think
no,
it was smaller
it was like
than that.
10 ounces. It was smaller.
But it was strong.
Yeah, it was very...
very good.
very, very stouty.
Gosh, I don't even remember being North Coast. It's crazy.
They also have the Prankster, the North Coast Stellar IPA, and the Old Stock Ale.
Hmm.
Just some of them. They have a lot of different brews that they make, but those stuck out a little bit more.
Yeah, familiar ones.
Okay, well, this is the part where we clink our glass and
cheers
it up.
Oh boy.
Oh.
Okay.
That doesn't taste like a regular ale would taste like.
Is this an ale?
It is a Belgian strong dark ale.
Mm-hmm.
It is 9.4% alcohol.
It definitely has that Belgian...
it's like...
Belgian hop to it.
To me, that Belgian style kind of seems like...
ale.
The Belgian ale... the Belgian ale... I said the Belgian style, first of all.
Oh, I thought you said stout.
No, Belgian style. It's like... It tastes more like a regular... You know... Not a craft beer.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like a...
Yeah, for sure.
Like one of your Modelos or Coronas or something like that. That kind of beer.
Yeah, no. The Belgian style is very distinct. And you can tell. Remember how I always mentioned that, like... That, like, whiskey barrel flavor?
Yeah.
That's what this reminds me of.
Not whiskey. It doesn't taste like whiskey.
I know, but it just has that barrel...
That aged taste. Mm-hmm.
Kind of smoky.
A little smoky, subtle.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a 9.4, so you gotta, you know.
Oh, yeah.
We have ourselves here it's a big bottle, actually.
Yeah, I don't think that's...
This is 1 pint. 750 milliliters. Isn't that what your small... Like whiskey bottles or vodka bottles come out to be?
Pretty much.
Yeah, so you have about 2 big servings of beer, 2.5 glasses of beer maybe, which will be okay for you, you know?
Yeah, I mean,
9.4, you'll be fine.
I'm gonna be good by the end of this podcast.
Yes, you will. So, this is the.
Story of a girl. I'm just kidding. Go on.
Okay. This is the Brother Thelonious. It is a, like I said, a Belgian strong dark ale. It is in honor of Thelonious Monk, who was a jazz pianist and composer.
Hmm.
And some of the profits from this beer are donated to the education programs at the Monterey Jazz Festival.
Naturally.
Which is, and then if you see the pattern of who they're exclusive to is the San Francisco Jazz and Oregon Jazz Party and Monterey Jazz Festival.
Mm.
So it's, you know.
A lot of jazz organizations.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool. I like that jazz is, you know, still recognized.
Oh, jazz is the shit.
No, I know, with the change in time and
style of everything,
that's cool that we are still incorporating it into our modern lives.
Go out there and listen to some jazz.
For sure.
It'll make your life a little bit better. Maybe. Okay, so let's get to it. What color do you see out of this?
Okay, so initially when you were pouring it, it, like, completely reminded me of the color of soda. But it's, like, a beautiful, like, naturally an ale color, but, like, a brown, like, red. You know what I mean?
It's like that, the wood floor coloring, the mahogany.
Yes, mahogany. Mahogany. There we go.
Dark brown. It's, you know, like you were saying, like a Coca-Cola color.
Yeah.
You know?
Maybe a little bit lighter than that, but
let's say watered down Coca-Cola.
I like mahogany. Let's stick.
Let's go with mahogany. What do you smell from it? I'm gonna smell it too.
There's
like a little bit of fruit.
Definitely fruity.
A little fruity.
But again, just to me, it smells like barrel. Like a...
I get what you're saying.
Barrel.
It's like a little malty little...
Yeah, malty, piney for sure.
Fruity, maybe a little like vanilla-y.
A hint of vanilla, yeah.
Are we going to say E to everything?
I mean...
Fruity, vanilla-y.
It's a hint of vanilla.
Chocolatey.
Oh, God. Okay, go on.
All right, taste. Give it a taste. Swirl it around.
It's definitely sweet. It comes off with like a hint of
I still taste like I don't know, for some reason I've been tasting like dark chocolate in these.
Yes.
Like dark chocolate.
Yes, I was just gonna say that too. Chocolate, maybe with a little bit of vanilla, but
the vanilla.
Chocolate stands out a lot.
A little malty film. You have that malty film when you drink it.
Guaranteed, yeah. And it's not too hop. I mean, it's not that it's not hoppy, but it's not too... I mean, obviously, it's not bitter at all. It's...
No, but it does leave that... On the side of your cheeks, it leaves, like, that sweet, filmy feeling, the residue on your cheeks.
Yes.
But then once it gets to your, like, throat, down your throat, down your...
It almost has, like, a hint of, like, liquor. Like, liqueur. You know what I mean?
I get what you're saying.
Like a syrupy kind of...
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But maybe that's the chocolate that I...
Yeah.
What are the ingredients in it?
What about tamarind?
Ooh, maybe that's what the chocolate is from. Because it's not... It's tamarindo. Not a full, like, chocolate flavor, but I see that. Because tamarind has that...
It's like that sweet, like, bitter
taste. Sweet and tangy flavor.
Yeah, there you go.
It's really... It's nice. It's very nice.
Yeah, it's...
It's different.
It's good. I like it.
We don't normally drink... It. Obviously, we don't normally drink Belgian-style ales, but... This is pretty good.
I think the last Belgian-style we did was, the Fat Tire.
Oh, my gosh. I haven't had Fat Tire in years.
What are you talking about? We did the podcast on a Fat Tire not that long ago. Well, like, the first two or three episodes.
No, we didn't.
Yeah. Fat Tire was one of them, I believe. Unless I'm mistaken completely. And
you are drunk.
No, I'm not. I don't get drunk ever.
Oh, that's okay. How about you tell us the ingredients for the time being?
The ingredients? Let's see. We have, well, let me show you, let me tell you about the bottle first, and then I'll give the sayings on the side. And
yeah.
And,
we're going off of taste, so I figured maybe we're gonna give us the ingredients on it.
Oh, well, like I said, I didn't find too much on it. And then most of the ingredients were, you know, flavors instead of ingredients. But, okay, this is a big 750 milliliter bottle.
Mm-hmm.
It has, North Coast Brewing Company on it, independent since 1988. It has a picture of Thelonious Monk playing his piano, probably composing something on there.
Uh-huh.
And it has a nice glass of beer on top of his piano. And it's he's pretty much like, the background is like a big window with a big solar window. And yeah. Underneath it says Bottled Bebop.
What is he, where is that, a what is
it, looks like bottle? It's it looks, no, it's like a sifter.
Oh.
Yeah, he has some beer in there. And it looks like, I don't know, some kind of like church window or some kind of thing like that.
Yeah.
Some kind of, you know, lighting like that.
Oh, I get it. I see it now. Okay.
Because it's like Brother Thelonious.
It almost looks, well, yeah. It looks very, like a gothic era kind of a thing.
It just looks like he's in, like, a castle or a...
Yeah.
You know, something like that.
Interesting.
Yeah, it says Bottle Bebop underneath, and it goes... And then it says Supporting Jazz Education. So they're big on jazz education. And, yeah. That's pretty much all to it right here. Other than the side, it says that, exact same thing from earlier about them being donating, about them donating a portion to the Monterey Jazz Festival.
Mm.
Yeah.
How often did you happen to catch how often these festivals are? They're year round or yearly or.
No, I did not.
That's okay.
I did not do my homework correctly.
Apparently.
And,
don't worry, I'll cover that with my 20 pages of notes for you.
Oh, there we go. And just to correct myself, I thought about it, and I don't believe we did the fat tire.
We did not.
But,
I would have recalled, but we definitely did not.
Yeah.
Who knows? Maybe we will.
Yeah. Who knows?
Man, this beer is either really strong or just because I haven't drank in a couple days, it is hitting me just right.
You know what this smells like? Banana. Smell it.
Why? Why?
Like, have you had a banana juice?
Maybe. Like a super ripe banana
that's, yeah, like that's what
going
it is.
Bad.
And bubblegum.
Okay, that's way too many flavors at this point.
And a little bit of, and I think I noticed a little bit of, what is that called? The ginger.
Okay, you're getting everything. Just and a little bit of basil and some lettuce and a tomato.
And I think I tasted some cilantro in there too.
Oh my goodness. Okay, well, that was pretty good. We got this from Ralph's.
Ralph's.
Our local Ralph's. Do you remember how much we got it for? I think it was like $9.99.
I think it was $9.99
yeah,
or $10.99.
It was like about $9.99. But again, we have Ralph's Club cards, so we get discounts here and there. It's pretty cool.
So it was 50 cents off.
Yeah, but I love the fact that Ralph's does these like 6-pack, like select your own.
Oh yeah, pick
make
your own six pack
or whatever
packs.
It is.
Yeah.
I think that's pretty cool, and there's options of cans or bottles, and especially now, they're bringing a lot of different craft beers and just a lot of different breweries, and it's nice.
A lot.
It's nice. And even, like, their 12-packs or their, yeah, most of their 12 and their 6-packs are a very big variety, and I love it. I absolutely love it. I love that the craft world is taking over.
One store at a time.
Indeed. But it's nice. That was great. Thanks, Jose. Awesome.
Yeah, I was a little off, but
it's
hey,
doing me good, and I don't blame you.
I'm not the important part of the podcast.
It's been a rough couple days, so it's okay. I understand.
Well, what do we have in store for our true crime of the week?
Okay, so, well, this one...
Take it away.
Thank you. So, there's a lot of different situations that occur, and all of them are so tragic and so heartbreaking. Anywhere from true crime to murder to homicide, whatever it may be, they're just the one thing that whoever's involved, or especially like the families that are involved, or whoever it may be, all they want is justice. And I think one of the saddest ones, like the saddest cases, are those that are either like cold cases or missing persons cases or disappeared cases, right? Because like a good portion of them don't have a conclusion, and that sucks because the families that are involved or whoever that's involved with those people just don't get the justice that they deserve. And for starters, nobody deserves to be in that situation to begin with. But to not have an answer is...
Yeah, to not have that closure.
The closure and answer, it just sucks.
Yeah.
It's a sad one. And for this one... I'm going to be doing, for today's episode, I've decided to cover the disappearance of Tara Calico. Not sure if you're familiar with her.
No, I'm not really.
That's okay. I'm going to give you the breakdown.
Oh, thank you.
Yes, so Tara Calico's disappearance has kept her family and authorities baffled for years. And there's a lot to this. And just getting into it, you don't know what to believe, and I'll explain that when I get there, but just bear with me. So, on September 20th, 1988, 19-year-old Tara Calico would leave her Bella, New Mexico home that she shared with her mother, Patty Dole, and stepfather, John Dole, and she would go on her daily bike ride. That would actually be the last time that Tara's family would ever see her again. So Tara was a college sophomore who loved to stay active. She was tall, pretty, and played many different sports. From the time that she was little, she was in like peewee cheerleading, softball, tennis, and was even part of the ski club.
Uh-uh.
Her daily bike rides consisted of riding 17 miles out and 17 miles back.
Wow.
That's daily. Can you imagine that?
That's wild.
I could barely get out there once a month, and let alone, wow. Anyway, I give her props on that one.
I could barely walk 17 steps.
I know. So wow. She enjoyed time to herself, according to the investigation discovery interview with Tara's stepsister, Michelle Dole. And
I believe her name is Tara.
Mm-hmm. I got excited and I read too fast. So Terry was a very organized person, and she enjoyed planning out her daily activities. She loved life and wanted to cover as many activities as she possibly could. Tara attended the University of New Mexico Valencia branch and was dating a gentleman by the name of Jack Cole, and they were pretty much like high school sweethearts. They were very much in love, and I think that they assumed that they were going to be together for a very long time. So the morning of September 20th, when Tara left for her bike ride, it was a little different than her usual mornings. So typically she would leave super early. Again, she loved to complete as many activities as possible, but this morning she was running behind and wouldn't leave her home until about 9:30 a.m. Also, her bike had a flat tire, so she had asked to borrow her mother's pink Huffy mountain bike instead. So before Tara left the house, she told her mother, Patty, that if she wasn't home by noon, to come after her, because she had a tennis date with her boyfriend at 12:30 and a class at 4:30.
Okay.
So because Tara's usual ride was around 35 miles, which would normally take any normal person about 4 to 5 hours, she didn't think she would be back in time for her tennis date. So that's why she like told her mom, like, hey, if I'm not back by this time, come looking for me.
Why not just not go?
Well, because it was her daily bike ride. It was, she had a lot of energy and she loved to be active. Like, that was one thing that I kept reading over and over again. Like, she was very active. She was such a happy person. Like, you know, endorphins make you happy, so.
Well, what if you take a shorter bike ride knowing that you're not going to make it on time? But yeah. I'm just picking at it.
Okay. But I mean, who knows? Maybe she was trying to push herself and she thought that she could get it done a little bit faster.
That's true.
Than what she normally would do. So Tara hops on the pink Huffy mountain bike and she pops on her yellow Sony Walkman that's playing Boston and proceeded to her route. Do you remember Walkmans?
Yeah, I have.
They were the shit.
I was the happiest person when I had a Walkman.
Oh my god, they were so cool. And then they came out with like CD players later, but like they would skip once in a while.
Oh, I got the CD player, the one that's a circular one.
Yeah, yeah.
With the shock resistant, but even though it wasn't shock resistant.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
Yeah. So she goes on her bike ride. So noon comes and Tara still isn't back. So at 12:05, Patty gets into her car to go pick up Tara, to like go find her. Patty proceeds down Tara's usual route, expecting to see her walking down the road with her bike. And Patty actually knew the route very well since she used to go on the same rides with Tara. However, Patty stopped going on the bike rides because she suspected someone of following or like watching them. And she was totally freaked out by this. She actually even tried to convince Tara to start carrying mace with her, whenever she went on these bike rides. But it's like, if you had this, I mean, yeah, granted, you can't really stop her because she's going to do what she wants. But, like, if you have this creepy feeling, why would you let her go by herself?
Can I ask you what year this was in again?
1988.
Oh, it wasn't even that often. Yeah.
No.
Okay. That,
30 years ago.
That's, 32 years ago. Wow, how funny is it that it's 30-something years already?
I know.
Okay.
Okay, so, right. So, Tara never thought twice about her mother's request just because she thought that she was, like, overreacting. And naturally, right, teenagers, that's, am I right? Like, that's what we think. I shouldn't say we, I'm not a teenager anymore, shit. But naturally, teenagers think that they're so invincible and, like, when they're younger, they just think, like, nothing bad will happen to them. They're like, I can take care of myself. I'm okay. Don't worry about it.
Yeah, they're going to do whatever they want to do when
they want to do it. And I was like that. And now I'm, like, older, and I'm like, shit, like, I'm more scared now than I was before. And I was like, why?
Well, duh.
I mean, naturally. But you know what I mean? Like, we don't think twice the way our parents do. And, ugh, having kids is going to be tough. Okay. So, Patty drives all the way down Route 47, but sees no sign of Tara. And thinking that Tara may have made it back to the house, Patty decides to go back to double check. So upon her arrival, she checks the garage, but still there's no sign of Tara. She decides to wake up her husband John and tells him what's going on and that she is going to go to the local areas nearby to continue her search. She once again returns home after searching for a little bit and checks the garage, but still no sign of the bike or Tara. So at this point, it's 12:35, and she's, like, in full panic mode. Jack, Tara's boyfriend, is expecting her at 12:30 for tennis, but when she doesn't show, he calls Tara's parents' house, and they tell him she's missing. So once Jack gets to the house, all three of them, Jack, Patty, and John, decide to go out and retrace their steps and continue their search. While they are out in the surrounding area that Tara may have been at, they encounter a few people. So first, they stop to speak with three men who had been working on a fence and asked if they had seen Tara, but they hadn't. They mentioned that they had left the area to go get food and drinks sometime between 11 to 11:30, so they may have missed her. They were really nice and they were very cooperative, so they thanked them and they went on. Shortly into the search, the three decide to split up in order to cover more ground. So Patty makes her way to the south of JFK campgrounds. Again, this is in New Mexico. And she notices a dirty white or like light gray truck with this like a homemade camper attached to it. Three men drinking beer stood in front of the truck, and Patty decided to approach them and ask if they had seen Tara. The men pretty much stated that they had not, and that they had been there since 11 a.m. So these men weren't actually really nice at all, and they didn't really seem like they wanted to help. As a matter of fact, they were very defensive when she came at them with all these questions. So they said their piece and just kind of stared at her until, like, Patty, like, walked away. Patty, John, and Jack regrouped and discussed their findings. Upon bringing up the truck, Jack and John were suspicious of the truck with the three men. So they decided to go back and question them one more time. And by this time, it's around 3:15 p.m., so it's been roughly about 3 hours that they've been searching. And again, they become even more defensive. The three men, they become even more defensive, especially since now there's two men approaching them asking about Tara.
Oh.
So the men form like kind of like a barricade in front of the truck, not as if to say that like, as if to say like, don't come any further. You know what I mean? Like as if back off.
Yeah, yeah.
So they told John and Jack the same thing that they told Patty, but this time they changed the time that they originally had said to 11:30. So originally when Patty talked to them, they said 11 a.m. and at this time they had said 11:30, and that they had not seen Tara at all. At 4:30 p.m., the police finally decided to get involved. So originally Patty had called the police, but they were kind of like, maybe she just went off and she'll be home in a little while.
She's out further or something.
So even though Patty had called them right when she thought Tara was missing, the police pretty much brushed it off, and like they kept saying like she's a grown woman and maybe she ran away. You know what I mean? Like if she wants to leave, she technically can.
Yeah.
So again, at 4:30 p.m., and Patty and the police officers return back to the JFK campgrounds and drive by the three men with the camper truck once again. But this time, they had actually moved their truck to an entirely different spot.
Was it the same three men?
It's the same three men.
What are they doing there waiting for 4 or 5 hours?
Well, from what I read, apparently this area, which I will mentioned further into my notes, that apparently it was like a hunting area.
Okay.
This JFK campgrounds, people usually hunted around there, but I'll get to that eventually. So the day of September 20th ended, and still there was no trace of Tara. And Patty knew something was wrong. It was not like Tara at all to just like up and leave and not mention anything. Like, she left with nothing. She left with a bike and a Walkman. Like, how far could she go? And obviously this is the 80s, so cell phones weren't really, you know, a thing back then. So she couldn't just be, like, calling her.
Were they?
What?
Were they?
In New Mexico.
No, I'm saying, were the cell phones a big thing at all?
I mean, they were big, but
not everybody could have a hold of them. I don't know if
they could all have them or carry them in such a manner as they do now. Okay, so the next day, Patty returns to Route 47 to see if she possibly missed anything. Excuse me. So Route 47 is the long stretch of road that Tara would ride her bike on. And it's a very, I hate this world, word, not world.
Huh.
This word.
The it's truth a comes very, out.
Rural area. It's a very rural area.
When is the second time you've had to say that word and you always...
I always mess it up, no matter what. I can't say it right. Okay. It's a very rural... Rural area. Populated area at the same time. So there's parts of it that are populated and parts that are not.
Okay.
So because of her long route, Tara was bound to ride through both parts. And as Patty moved slowly along the road, she found something that made her kind of sick. She came across a Boston cassette tape in the dirt. And she remembered that Tara had actually been listening to that tape when she left the house.
Oh.
Police also found broken pieces of a yellow Walkman by the JFK campgrounds. So, Patty identified both items as Tara's, and police stated that the items were not enough to suspect foul play, but Patty believed Tara was leaving these pieces behind almost like a breadcrumb trail, right? So, many eyewitnesses came forward and mentioned they had seen Tara. Many remembered her because they saw her every single morning. Again, this was her normal, everyday route.
Not to mention the bright pink bike.
Well, right, but this was the... the bright pink bike. I was going to say this was the first time that they had seen it, but it's true because it was a bright pink bike.
Yeah.
So, some even witnessed a white or gray truck with a camper following behind her slowly. And as they recalled, it wasn't apparent that Tara knew she was being followed. So police would finally admit that Tara had actually been abducted upon discovery of all the items in the eyewitness accounts. And another thing is, like, I mean, I'm sure this was true back in the day, but this whole 24-48-hour rule, don't believe that shit. If you feel like something is in danger, someone is in danger or is missing, whatever it may be, if it's out of their normal routine when they're supposed to be somewhere and they're not, contact the police. Don't wait. You don't need to wait 24 hours. Fuck that shit. Get somebody involved. You know what I mean?
Well, that's to file an actual missing
person. Not even the, that's not even the point, because it's like the first couple of hours that somebody actually does go missing are so crucial, and they hold the most evidence and the most key that, like, if police don't interact at that moment or get involved somehow at that moment or try to even try something, then they're losing time and evidence is just practically being blown away.
Yeah, it could be tampered with. It could be,
anything. So, the leads coming in all pretty much led to a dead end. And months would go by, and then suddenly, 9 months later, a piece of evidence would surface almost 1,500 miles away, shocking everyone. It was June 15th, 1989, when a mysterious Polaroid picture was discovered in a convenience store parking lot in Port St. Joe, Florida. So the terrifying photo showed a teenage girl and a young boy lying on sheets and a pillow in what appeared to be the back of a van, and both of them had duct tape over their mouths, and they were bound.
Wait, from New Mexico all the way to Florida?
Yes.
Wow, that's... Wow.
So, the boy in the photo looks terrified, and the girl looks rather, like, pissed, actually. Like, she's mad. Like, as if to say, like, why are you taking my picture, to the person that is taking it, and just kind of saying, like, I'm not afraid of you. Like, the little boy, again, looks terrified in the picture, and I'll be sure to post a picture of this, but the girl looks mad.
Hmm.
Also in the photo, next to the girl, lay a book by author V.C. Andrews titled My Sweet Audrina. And this photo is actually debuted on a show called A Current Affair. The show covered, like, smaller cases that actually did not receive as much attention on bigger news outlets. From this show, a friend of John Dole, who's Tara's stepfather, tells him that he has seen this photo while watching the show, and the girl resembled Tara a lot.
Mm.
So John calls the Valencia Police Department and reports what they believe to be a break in the case. Patty was convinced the girl in the photo was Tara. At first, she kind of didn't believe it, but after looking at it for so long, like, she mentions how, like, Tara used to, you know, wear makeup and, like, her hair was done and blah, 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 but obviously if she's captured and missing, like, she doesn't have the opportunity to do these things. Eventually she's pretty much convinced, but it's not only because that the girl looked similar to Tara, but she also had a scar on her leg, and again, you'll see this when I post it, but the girl's wearing, like, shorts, and she has her, like her legs up, like, her knees are kind of, you know, bent up, and she has a scar on her leg, and Patty thinks this is a scar that Tara had gotten. It was very similar to a scar that Tara had gotten from a car accident back in high school.
Hmm.
Another red flag to Patty was the book in the photo. So V.C. Andrews was one of Tara's favorite authors, and although this couldn't be considered as a piece of it, as a piece, like, connected to Tara, only because at that time V.C. Andrews was, like, the author of the moment.
Yeah, so it was a very bought out or distributed book between everybody.
Yes. It's kind of like how J.K. Rowling, like, kind of blew up here, and it was all over the place with the whole Harry Potter.
It blew up everywhere.
I mean, all over the, you know what I mean, all over the place. So it was kind of like that. So, the woman who actually discovered the photo called the police immediately, and she described a white Toyota van parked in the spot before she got there. The driver appeared to be a young man in his 30s with a mustache. So, at that time, when this photo is found, police set up a roadblock in an attempt to locate either the car or the driver, but they were unsuccessful with both. So, experts at the Los Alamos National Laboratory. I don't know why I say laboratory. Laboratory. Doubted that it was Tara, and the FBI was unable to offer conclusive evidence either way. So they got involved, but neither of them could determine whether it was Tara or not. However, the Scotland Yard in the UK, also known as the headquarters for the Metropolitan Police Service, were able to confirm that the girl in the photo was Tara. Even Polaroid, the company, was contacted to examine the photo, and the most that they could get out of it was that they could determine the photo had been taken no later than May of that year, because the specific film that was used was not available before that.
Okay.
So this photo is broadcasted, and another New Mexico family comes forward, and they claim that the little boy was their son, Michael Hensley, who also went missing during a camping trip with his father in New Mexico's Zuni Mountains.
Wait, was that the little boy that was with her?
Yes, in the photo.
Okay.
So, unfortunately, in 1990, the boy's remains were actually discovered just a few miles from the campground, and police pretty much believed that he had wandered off and just kind of died of exposure. So, they kind of put that to rest.
Wait, they didn't find any kind of
signs of, you know...
No, that was just it. They didn't.
That's why they ruled it a...
Yeah. Just, he...
Cold, he couldn't survive. Or something.
Cold, hungry, heat, exhaustion, whatever it may have been, he just... It didn't appear to be like any kind of foul play, basically.
That's kind of wild for a little kid to be in.
Yeah, I mean, he wandered off and he probably got lost in the forest, in the woods, and whatnot. Yeah. Okay. So, Melinda Esquivel, a friend of Tara's from high school, had returned back to Belen years later and questioned classmates about Tara's disappearance. Ironically, her classmates had mentioned that, like, they were like, what do you mean, like, didn't you know what happened to Tara? And apparently, they came out to say that she had died, and pretty much her murder was actually a cover-up. So, Tara and Melinda basically knew each other when, so Tara was, like, kind of like the, not popular girl, but she was, like,
Well known.
And Melinda was not. So, at one point, I think Tara was really nice to her, and Melinda really liked that about her. She was just, she invited her to sit with her during lunch or something like that, but she was just really nice to her when other people were not. So, Melinda had eventually, like, left Belen. She went to college, and she left New Mexico, and she created a new life in California. So, she was so bothered by what her classmates had mentioned about Tara's disappearance/murder/cover-up that she actually decided to dig into the case a little further herself. Melinda Esquivel is actually the host of a podcast called Vanished, and she actually covers Tara's case in much more detail, like further detail. I actually just started listening to it after I discovered that she is the host and that she also covers the story, but this wasn't...
Wait, this is her actual friend?
Yes.
Wow, that's...
Right, which is really cool.
That's very interesting.
She was determined to get justice for Tara, and she wanted all the details out there, and it's... If anybody wants a new podcast to listen to, check out Vanished. I'm just starting it, and so far it's really good.
Tell them Murder on Tap sent you.
Kind of. I mean,
I'm just saying that to everything.
No, I'm just kidding. Okay, so Melinda and Tara's stepsister were actually given access to the police records, Tara's police records. And these records were such a mess. Like, the folders were all messed up. The files were messed up. There was folders that had names on them, but they didn't even have anything in them, or the files were in the wrong folders. Like, it was just a mess.
Oh, I thought you meant it was gonna. It's a mess. Like, there's so much stuff.
No. It's literally garbage.
Wow.
What they found. So, this led Melinda to believe that the sheriff's department might actually be involved somehow. So, okay, so let's talk about the sheriff at that time was, during Tara's disappearance, was Lawrence Romero Sr. He became sheriff in 1974 after he was encouraged to run during the election of it, and he had wife, kids, great life, and this little piece of detail that I found out was very interesting. So, he actually went on to purchase a bar, like, own a bar, and there was a lot of, like, fights and situations that happened at this bar, and it's kind of weird to think that a sheriff owns a bar to begin with.
Yeah, that's a little far-fetched.
A little bit. It's kind of like a, I don't know, it's a little bit of like an oxymoron, but he, I mean, it isn't, but, I mean, anybody can own a bar, but you know what I mean? It's just, it's a weird, it's weird to think that he would pursue that, especially as a sheriff, right? So, he begins drinking, obviously, as some people tend to when they have their own establishment that has a lot of liquor in it.
Yeah, of course.
And he, it takes a toll on his life. He becomes an alcoholic, obviously, but eventually he becomes very sick. He has, like, problems with his liver, and he realizes that he has to stop drinking, so he does. He cleans up his act.
Oh, it's because of the alcoholism?
Yes. Okay. So, there's a reason why I'm bringing up Lawrence Romero Sr., and you will see why eventually.
Is there a junior?
I'll get there.
Okay.
So, let's talk about some of the eyewitnesses that saw riding, that saw Tara riding her bike that morning. So, four hunters were hunting near the general area of the JFK campgrounds, and they were actually interviewed on September 24th, 4 days later, after seeing Tara's picture on the news. So, the hunters had pulled over to discharge their rifles when they saw Tara riding on her bike. They also happened to notice a man in a truck, in a white, light gray truck, watching Tara very intently. So, they assumed that this man in the older truck, in the older Ford truck, was someone who may have known Tara or, like, was with Tara, possibly because... like, possibly, like, looking after her because of the way this man was staring at Tara. But at the same time, it was very unsettling.
Like a creepy,
Yes, way, yeah. Major creepy stare. So, the hunters were actually hypnotized, and I believe they were taken to the same area that Tara went missing.
Wait, just what do you mean hypnotized?
Yes, they were hypnotized. The sheriff's department, like, hypnotized
literally
them.
Literally hypnotized them?
Yes, they were hypnotized. Just to see if they could recall any further detail from that morning. But the results of what they said during the sessions was actually missing from the records.
They didn't add that into it?
They didn't. They left it out. They left it out of their files. Like I said, the folders and the files were... just messed up.
Yeah, they were just tossed in there.
Yeah, so, okay, so their statements are pretty much missing. Ishmael De La Rosa is another witness. So, Ishmael was actually traveling to Belen to pick up some new calves after one of his calves had died suddenly. He was actually pulling a horse trailer that carried this dead calf in it, and he was going to make a stop at the vet first to figure out what had caused the death before making his way to pick up the new calves, right? So, there's this old, white or gray Ford pickup truck with a camper that's driving in front of him, and it's going super slow. It's going so slow that it's as if the truck is, like, practically stopped. And this is agitating Ishmael a lot, because he's just trying to get to the vet before it closes. Like, it's a rush job, and he's just trying to pass his truck. So Ishmael notices that the truck is following a girl on a bike, aka Tara, and he has an uneasy feeling about the way the driver keeps staring at this girl. It appeared that he was staring pretty much at Tara's butt. And the driver, when Ishmael gets close to pass the truck, he's like side by side with him, he notices that the driver has like this super bright red hair. And he's wearing a hat, like, you know those little hats that have, like, the flaps that fold down? Not sure what they're called, but, you know, like, you kind of wear them during the winter or something.
Yeah, I think those are, I get what you're saying.
Right. So,
they're, like, wool on the side and everything.
Yeah, yeah. So, he's wearing a hat, and he appears to be very clean cut, almost like a military style. He had, like, a little bit of stubble on his face, but, like, no more than, like, a day or two. And his eyes...
shadow.
Pretty much. The driver's eyes appear to be very bloodshot, as if he had been drinking just recently. And Ishmael notices 5 khaki shirts hung up in the back of the camper. And they were strangely hung up almost side by side. Like, they were pressed, they were like, as if they had just been picked up from the dry cleaner. And they're pressed very neatly, and they're just hung up in the back of the camper, like, as if they're blocking something, right?
Okay.
The view of something.
Yeah.
So, Ishmael knew that there was something was not right about the man watching Tara. She definitely had no idea that she was being watched, and the truck was also keeping some distance. Ishmael eventually passes the truck and notices other people on the road. So he sees 2 men wearing sports coats walking on either side of the on the other side of the fence by the field. So they're just kind of walking. And he sees a white and black car, one parked on either side of the highway, and there's a man in a white t-shirt leaning against the white car. Further down the road, he notices a stopped car with the hood open, and there's like 5 people standing around the car, but they're not really like tending to the car. Like, if you see someone with an open hood, you would assume that something is wrong and that, you know, they're checking out their car, but they're not even doing that. They appear to have been like just bouncing around, kind of, as I read in one of the things, like as if they were on drugs, basically. So
okay, that's interesting.
This is just like what he witnesses, right? This is just, Ishmael has a really good memory from what I heard, apparently. I would not be able to remember all that detail, but
so this
amazing.
Is just on his account.
This is just on his account, yeah.
What he thinks is going on, not...
No. It's just what he saw while he was driving to get to the vet, and he passes this truck, and he notices all these different, because like they wanted all the witnesses to identify what they had seen on the road.
Compare everything at the end and see
right.
What, yeah.
Right.
Okay.
So, a few days later, Ishmael saw the story on Tara on the news, and he didn't really put 2 and 2 together at that time. Like, he didn't realize that it was the same girl that he had seen on the road. But once he does realize this, he actually calls a tip line and is eventually contacted by Captain Ray Flores, who takes his statement. So Ray Flores was actually a captain under Sheriff Romero at that time, Lawrence Romero Sr.
Mm-hmm.
And Flores didn't seem to really care about Ishmael's statement, like as if it was more of a bother to him, like he was bothering him with this. So, but eventually they get in contact with him again, and they want to hypnotize him as they had done with the hunters. So Captain Flores tells Ishmael they will meet the next day to look over some trucks for him to identify and compare, but Captain Flores actually never calls or even shows up.
So he just seems like he doesn't care.
Yeah, pretty much. He doesn't even...
blows it off and that's it.
Yeah. So a month after receiving a call back, Ishmael would actually spot the pickup truck and the driver somewhere in Albuquerque, New Mexico. So Ishmael returns to the police department to tell the investigators about his sighting, but once again, he's brushed off. But this time, he just didn't care. He told them regardless whether they wanted to listen or not, he told them the story. So Ray Flores reaches out once again and asks Ishmael to help with the composite sketch of the driver of the Ford pickup truck. While talking to Flores, Ishmael brought up some local gossip. So his friend Jack Aguayo believed that his grandson, JJ Aguayo, was either involved or knew something about Tara's disappearance.
Oh, the new lead.
So JJ had mentioned to his grandfather that they were hunting out in the same area where Tara was on her bike ride that day. So Jack Aguayo owned a large piece of land, and he even went on to say that he wouldn't be surprised if Tara was buried somewhere on his property. And he's telling Ishmael this, right? So the night of Tara's disappearance, someone had gone through the back gate of Jack's property, and apparently nobody ever went in or out of that back gate. Like, it was never open. And whoever did go through the gate had actually left it wide open.
But it was accessible to anyone?
I'm pretty sure it was.
Like, it was in the view where everybody could just...
I mean, if it's a big property, I can only imagine it's like some kind of a gate at the back end of the property, you know what I mean? Why would anybody...
That's true.
If it's not your property, you know what I mean? Why would you go in and out of it?
That's true. Yeah, okay.
So when the police went to interview JJ, they found out that he was actually, he had pretty much like skipped town, and apparently he was in some kind of mental hospital, institute in Texas. I shouldn't say skipped town, but apparently he was in some mental institute. So even though Jack Aguayo was the one to mention everything, in the end, he almost wanted to back out of his statement, saying he wanted nothing to do with it, and he wanted nothing to do with the case after all. So on September 11th, 1991, a search warrant was enacted to search Jack Aguayo's property and ranch. But no records were ever found of the search of Jack's property. Again, the file folder messed up. Another witness comes forward, and his name is Baron Freeman. So Baron had attempted to call the police and give a statement, but was constantly brushed off for years. In 2008, Baron remembered a new development emerged when Sheriff Rene Rivera went on to announce that he knew what had happened to Tara, but because there was no body, he basically couldn't make an arrest. Baron was angered by this, and he knew that they were lying. 20 years and 3 days after Tara Calico went missing, Baron Freeman finally gave a statement. 20 years.
20 years. Oh, you said something about
20 years and 3 days.
3 days. Wait.
Oh, because they just didn't. They didn't want to hear it. The police didn't care. They didn't want to hear his statement.
So what is it? A new sheriff came into town and was like, I'm opening this up.
Well, not even just opening it up. He just came and he opened his mouth and he said, like, I know what happened, but, like, why would you go out there and say that you knew what happened, but because there's no body that you can't do anything? Then why are you saying you know something? Do you know what I mean? Like, that's pretty shady.
It sounds a little corrupt.
Yes. We'll get there.
And which goes with what you were saying, what the friends were saying.
Yes.
About
it being a cover-up. A
cover-up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you'll see. Okay, so Baron remembers driving to the airport that day, and it was gray, and it was a gray and gloomy day, especially after the rains. So Baron remembers Tara's pink bike and a dirty white slash gray truck with a camper on it. So just to emphasize why I'm emphasizing on the gray and gloomy day is because of the fact that when he's giving his statement to the police officer, he tells the police officer, yeah, it was a gray, rainy day. And the police officer turns to him and goes, no, it wasn't. It was a sunny day that day. What are you talking about? And Baron's like, what do you mean? Like, it was a gray and gloomy day that day. Like, there's photos of it being gray. Like, every single person that made a statement said it was a gray and gloomy, rainy day. Like, the rains had just happened and everything was, like, brown and just, like, there was no greenery, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So this hot pink bike would have stood out to anybody.
Of course, yeah. Either way, a hot pink bike
would stand out. I mean, not hot pink, sorry, just a bright pink bike.
Well, either way, a pink bike would stand out anywhere.
To anybody.
Yeah.
So Baron remembers the pink bike again and this white truck basically following right behind her. The driver appeared to be somewhere in his, like, between 40 and 50 and watching Tara very creepily. Baron had to catch a flight, so he kept on driving. And because he had noticed his driver, like, creepily staring at Tara, he wanted to say something or, like, to pull over and, like, ask Tara if she needed help. But when he passes her, he tries to make eye contact with her, but she doesn't seem like she has any idea of what's going on, so yeah. He just assumes that everything is fine. And just like all the other witnesses, he assumes that maybe this person knows Tara and is just driving along with her. So he overthought the situation, and he felt very terrible for not going back to make sure that Tara was okay. And this is like by the time he's on his airplane already.
Yeah.
So Baron was actually 10 years later, Baron meets up with Patty, Tara's mom, and basically apologizes to her for not doing more, for not going back, for not helping Tara. He feels like he has this guilt and this burden on his shoulders, like as if it's his fault. And Baron was actually never hypnotized like the other witnesses.
So the other people were hypnotized by the police department?
Yes. Or like they brought in somebody, a specialist to
hypnotize. But the police department did it.
Yes.
So do you think they were trying to just cover that up by
trying to make it seem like they were doing an extensive search?
Yeah.
Probably.
Mm-hmm. And since this guy wasn't hypnotized at all, he's like, you know what? I'm going to come on and just...
Right.
Okay.
I mean, what would have mattered? Because apparently the files were so messed up that even if he was, would they have lost it? Would they have not recorded it? You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's true. Why would they have leaven and left it out?
Mm. So, another witness comes forward, but she asked to stay anonymous because she actually feared for her life. The morning of Tara's disappearance, this woman... By the way, this witness is a woman. So she was on her way to school at that time because she was still a student, and she happened to see Tara on her usual route. They knew each other, and she remembers waving to Tara, and she went on with her day, and she went to school.
But she was noticed by her?
Yes.
Okay.
She knew her. They knew each other.
I mean, that day, they...
They noticed each other. They waved to her. They waved to each other, and this girl goes off, and she goes to school. So after she passes Tara, she pulls in front of a truck that was following behind Tara. She remembers the driver and passenger giving her dirty look as she passed by them. And later that evening, she goes on about her day, and she goes home later that evening. And this witness meets up with her boyfriend, who informs her that Tara has actually gone missing because the boyfriend was actually involved in the search.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Excuse me.
I was going to say, how did he know so quickly?
Yeah, he got word of it and he went out to search with them. So she recalls the truck and she calls the police. The next day, the police arrive at her home to take a statement and show her a photo lineup of potential suspects. She identified two of the men she saw in the truck, and the police thanked her and they told her that they would be in touch with her.
Not.
They never contacted her again.
Wow.
And she basically just assumed that, you know what, they took my statement and I guess they don't really need my help anymore. Like, they got what they needed. If they need me, they'll call me back, you know?
Yeah, they'll run with that and, yeah.
So, several years later, when this witness was looking over a magazine, she was looking through a magazine, she came across an article about Lawrence Romero Jr. Remember Lawrence Romero Sr., the sheriff back in Tara's case?
The son came back. Well, yes. Came out. Yeah.
He came out. So the picture of Lawrence Romero Jr. was actually the same picture and the same person she identified in the photo lineup that day.
Wait, she picked out Junior?
She did.
Wow.
She, when the police came to take her statement the day after Tara's disappearance, she identifies these two men from a photo lineup that they bring to her home. And when she's going through this magazine several years later, she notices Lawrence Romero Jr. and she remembers him from the lineup photos.
It all makes sense now.
So Lawrence Romero Jr. had either, at this time, Lawrence Jr. had either committed suicide or been involved in a game of Russian roulette, which is really bizarre. Because it's like, why would you put yourself in that situation? But then again, I don't know how true that is, but it's a possibility.
That is the worst game you could play.
So, this witness was absolutely certain that that Lawrence was the same man in the lineup photo because of his distinct red hair. So, like, she even mentioned, like, there was, like, no other like it. Like, it was so bright that if you saw it, you would recognize it anywhere.
There's certain things, like, if people have certain features that are very recognizable that they not many other out. People have.
Yeah.
Of course people are going to remember it.
Absolutely. And that's a thing. Like, always pay attention to your surrounding and the people around you. Just in case. You never know what can happen, and you just want to have a better idea in case you need to explain it to somebody.
Remember that person with the really bright shirt or the...
Yeah. Really, look around you, people. Look around you.
The only guy that was wearing shorts at the party. Don't just
be buried in your phone and not paying attention. Yeah. Look around you. Okay. We're almost getting to the end. Sorry. I know this is a long one. Thank you for bearing with me, but it's a good one. It's just... Oh, man. Okay. So, this witness realizes how deep the cover-up actually really was. So, Lawrence Romero Sr. was directly in charge of Tara's case for a very long time. If we take into consideration this anonymous witness claims, then she picked out Romero Jr. and was basically never heard of again, and her statement was never filed. So this witness also recalls speaking with Sheriff Rene Rivera when
I think you should drink. You haven't drank the whole time.
I know I haven't. I should.
There you go.
Thanks.
This drink is brought to you by Murder on Tap.
This case. Okay.
Oh, the drink.
So the witness recalls speaking with Sheriff Rene Rivera when he took over the position and remembers him saying he knew who was involved and how they had some pretty higher connections in the community and basically people were covering it up. So Sheriff Rivera even mentioned knowing where the truck was and that it was hidden under a tarp somewhere, like some guy's property, with the bumpers removed. Okay, and then remember J.J. Aguea?
Yeah.
Right? So the guy that supposedly ended up in the mental hospital. So his statement was actually never officially taken. They just questioned him.
I don't understand how all this is happening.
Oh, that's what I'm saying. That is what I'm saying. It gets crazier. Okay. So, right. So he was questioned, but his statement was never taken. And it was stated that he went off the grid, supposedly, to, like, a mental institution in Texas. But JJ had said to his grandfather that he and another gentleman by the name of Paul Zeiler were actually out hunting that same day and in the same area as Tara was in. So Paul Zeiler, this friend of JJ, is actually brought in for questioning. And he's asked about the vehicle that he was driving at that time. And he had said that it was a silver, like, wonton with a flatbed. But at the same time, like, kind of under his breath, he goes, well, it could have been a gray truck. You know what I mean? Like,
and he, there we go.
Right? So he's like, whatever. He's like, very whatever about it. He says, it could have been gray, I guess. So, and when the police question him where the truck is at the time, he says that he pretty much sold it. It's no longer in his possession.
Yeah, it's gone.
So police don't mention to Paul that JJ had told them about seeing Tara. So when they ask Paul about this, about seeing a girl on a pink bike, Paul pretty much says, I sure don't. And his answer alone is very, like, not giving a fuck. Like, he's just like, nope. Like, he's very cocky about it. And he's very confident. Like,
eh, whatever.
Yeah. Just whatever. He doesn't even care.
Yeah.
So, no mention of the camper, even though supposedly they had gone camping. But instead, he says that, like, oh, they just slept in a tent. Which, I mean, obviously is still realistic, but you know what I mean? There's so many eyewitnesses that mention this camper.
Yeah, that throws it off a bit.
So, in addition to all of that, JJ had mentioned at one point that there was a third person who was supposed to join them during this camping trip, but they never showed up. So Paul claims that there never was a third person, and there never was supposed to be a third person. So he's like, no, he's just talking out of his ass, basically.
So there's only two total?
Two total.
That's what he is saying, but witnesses are saying...
Well, not witnesses, but JJ had mentioned that maybe a third person may have showed up, but Paul's like, no, he doesn't know what he's talking about. There was never a third person.
Okay.
In addition to that, police questioned Paul about knowing Lawrence Romero Jr., and he says that he never knew him. Eventually, it would come out that Paul definitely knew Lawrence Jr. He knew him so well that, in fact, they actually purchased drugs from the same dealer.
What?
They did drugs together, they drank together, they partied together. And usually the partying would actually be done at Lawrence Jr.'s trailer. Eventually, Paul would be let go, and he would be called back again. But by that time, he had actually lawyered up and refused to talk. Another female comes forward, and she actually used to hang out with JJ, and she recalls one time when they were hanging out that JJ made a confession while under the influence of either drugs or alcohol. So he basically spills the beans, and he mentions that he knew what had happened, he couldn't do anything about it, and he just wanted to tell somebody. Another gentleman by the name of Henry Brown steps forward, and he's actually on his deathbed, and he wants to make a deathbed confession. So Henry Brown used to actually hang out with Lawrence Romero Jr. and, like, JJ and some of the other guys. So he recalls Lawrence Jr. actually having a crush on Tara, and apparently Lawrence had attempted to ask her out multiple times, but Tara had kindly rejected him since she already had a boyfriend. So, this was the first, this is the first time that sheriffs learn of Lawrence Romero Jr. knowing Tara. So apparently these guys used to hang out in a makeshift basement under Lawrence Jr.'s trailer, which I'm kind of confused. What is that, like a fucking dirt hole? Like, would you guys dig a dirt hole and you just hung out? You know what I mean?
Yeah,
right. Like, what is a makeshift basement underneath a trailer? Isn't that kind of weird?
Yeah, that is, yeah, I understand what you're saying.
So one night, they're all hanging out, they're drinking and doing drugs, and eventually some of the guys, being inebriated, began to talk about Tara and how they had been involved in her disappearance and eventually murder. So they followed behind her and hit her with their truck, only to grab her eventually and put her in the back of the truck. They take her away and they proceed to rape her. And when Tara tells them that when she gets away from them, that she's going to tell authorities what they had done. So obviously, because they don't want to get caught, they end up stabbing her to death, and she dies. So Lawrence Jr. claims that they had hidden her body in this makeshift basement until moving her body to a nearby pond. Lawrence Jr. threatened Henry Brown that if he ever went to the cops, that he would actually kill him himself. And since Henry Brown was already on his deathbed, he didn't want to hold on to the secret forever. Unfortunately, the case still stands and was never closed. Many of the suspects actually are no longer living, and because they are no longer alive, law enforcement basically just thought that there was, like, no reason to talk about it or to do anything about it anymore. But in reality, Tara Calico needs justice. Her family needs justice. Even just a body to be able to bury is a huge deal. Like, just to give her a gravestone and to put her body to peace, like, have her family members visit her at the least. So a way that you all can help is by putting pressure on politicians and law enforcement to solve this case in New Mexico. So you can either call the district attorney, Linuel Martinez, at 505-861-0311, or you can get in touch with the Attorney General of New Mexico, Hector Balderas, at 505-490-4060, to encourage them to investigate into this corruption. So Patty, Tara's mother, would eventually pass away, never knowing what happened to her daughter, and as did her birth father. Tara is survived by her stepfather and her stepsister, and they will never stop searching for an answer or the truth about what happened to Tara. Recently, in October of 2019, the FBI announced a $20,000 reward for information that could lead to Tara's whereabouts or an arrest and conviction of those who are responsible. Anyone that has information about Tara's disappearance should contact the FBI at 1-800-CALL-FBI or the General Attorney or District Attorney of New Mexico again, because this is not okay. I know it's been some time, and I think that they still have hope that she may still be alive, and who knows, hopefully she is, if hopefully the rumors aren't true, but any kind of help would be great. And that is a disappearance of Tara Calico. Sorry that took me forever, but it's just such an emotional case, and it's just all the factors that go into it. You're just like, really? Like, these are people who are supposed to be helping, and not to say that they don't, because there's a lot of great police officers out there who do their job and they bring justice to families who are searching for missing loved ones or, you know, past loved ones. But this doesn't sound right. It's just not settling right, especially with all the people that are involved and all the witnesses that came forward.
Yeah, you're right. That's true. This was a. It sounds like a little bit of negligence by the police department and.
Indeed.
Yeah, crazy.
Just to cover myself, also, some of the information that I. Some of the research that I got was actually from an article on All That's Interesting, Investigation Discovery, and this really great YouTuber by the name of Stephanie Harlow. She had a lot of great information. And again, if you haven't yet, check out the Vanished podcast. That's Melinda Esquivel, and she also goes into extensive detail about Tara's disappearance. And well, with that, Jose, take us into the A-OK of the week, because I think people are done listening to my voice.
Well, thank you. All right. Our story, our A-OK of the week is from Good News Network, as usual, because they put out the good news on their network.
And they're our best friends.
And they're our buddy buddies, or close buddies, even though they don't know it. But the headline reads, heartwarming video shows FedEx driver secretly shoveling snow off of customer's front stoop.
Oh my goodness.
So this FedEx driver is being hailed for going above and beyond the call of duty to help out a neighbor during a routine delivery run. Jody LaFrenie, I should have practiced this beforehand.
You should have drank.
Yeah, hold on. Here, you take a look at it before I actually get it? Good luck.
LaFrenier?
Okay, whatever. Jody LaFrenier. I'm going to say Frenier.
Is it French?
It sounds French. Okay. Jody LaFrenier is a kindergarten teacher who had been away from her home in Manistique, Michigan, when the good deed took place last week. Correct me if I'm wrong. I'm going with Manistique. Since her doorbell security camera is activated by motion, she got a notification text on her cell phone about someone approaching her home. Upon looking at the security footage, it sounds like a weird way to say security, huh? Security footage. Upon looking at the security footage, she saw a FedEx driver walking a package up to her door. When he caught sight of all the snow on her front yard, on her front stoop, however, he put down the package, grabbed a shovel, and began clearing away the snow. And I quote, although we see many acts of kindness in the Upper Peninsula, A-OKs, that's not part of the quotation. That's just me saying it. It was still surprising to see that he went the extra step. End quote. LaFrenier told CNN. I shared it with my coworkers immediately because I couldn't believe it. It made my day. The delivery driver, Melvin J. Marlette, has reportedly been working for FedEx for 23 years. Although I'm trying to pronounce it correctly.
That's okay. You're doing pretty well.
Is usually never home to greet him during his deliveries. Her fiancé says he has shared many delightful conversations with the driver. And again, we go, LaFrenier. It's kind of fun to say, though. LaFrenier. LaFrenier. Later reached out to Marlette and asked for his permission to post the video in hopes that it would harden others on social media. And her wish has now come true, since her Facebook video of the incident has already been viewed more than 57,000 times.
Wow.
Despite how Marlette humbly insists that he was simply doing his job, he says he is also happy his good deed is having such a positive effect on the internet. I would hope it's something that anybody would have done, Marlette told the news outlet. If you take care of your customers, they take care of you.
Aww. And then he stole their package. I'm just kidding.
No, he wouldn't do that.
I'm kidding.
And there's a little video. If you guys go to goodnewsnetwork.org and just look up the headline that I read, heartwarming video shows FedEx driver shoveling snow off a customer's stoop. There's a little video on there. We can't play it here. We're not going to play it here, but... And I think we can't play it here, even though we're not big. But it's also like, why are we going to watch a video while you guys are listening?
Yes, you guys should check it out and give the video some hits.
If you have Facebook, do it. Go to newsnetwork.org and do it. But look, a little thing. My brother, one of my brothers is a driver for one of these delivery companies.
Does he shovel snow?
We don't have snow in California. But I'm sure he would do a good deed like that for somebody.
No doubt.
Spider webs.
Oh my goodness. Cleaning
off spider webs. No, not cleaning off spider webs. It's never mind. Oh. You didn't get it. No doubt, spider webs. Oh. Okay. Well, let's end the podcast on this. Everybody, stay safe.
Yes.
Stay healthy.
Tell all the people around you how much you love them. Give them hugs. Give them kisses. And just be good to one another because life is short.
I heard somebody say, celebrate people while they're here. Not when they're gone.
Exactly.
So.
Indeed. Thank you for listening. Thank you for joining us. I'll catch you here again next week. Cheers.
Cheers, everybody.
And toodles.
And we love you.